Many of the people who participated in these podcasts have undertaken PhDs or held research positions at universities across New Zealand, Australia, and the US, and so have had to work within the formal research structures that universities have developed. This podcast focuses on the impact of the university ethics evaluation process, which demands that when engaging with human and animal research subjects, an extensive and rigorous written proposal be submitted to the Ethics Committee before the research can commence. Moana Napier, Sally Morgan, Carol Brown, Mark Harvey, David Cross, Becca Wood, Alice Longley, Mark Jackson, Chris Braddock, Rose Martin, Stephen Bain, and Brent Harris explore how they negotiate a university ethics process initially developed for medical, animal, sociological, and anthropological research, identifying when it becomes effective for creators working in universities, and where the disjunctions between research methods and creation processes occur.
The fact that there's a lack of guidelines for ethics considering performance within academic institutions is something we could talk about, yeah. And how they need to seriously engage professionals with extensive experience in the field to help shape those sort of guidelines. Mm.
Probably the first moment you think about the your work and ethics and put them in the same sentence, in other than a kind of musing sort of internal way, is when you're confronted with, does this project have to go to the Ethics Committee or not? And that's where those thoughts, you know, most of my thoughts have been marshalled for probably at least 12 years, probably a little longer.
And I think what happens, Melissa, is that, you know, we avoid the ethics thing.
I don't want to go for ethics and approval, and I don't think it's relevant. And in order to get ethics approval, what I'll have to do is get everyone who participates to fill out forms. But then how can you do that if you want people semi-unsuspecting from the street, yeah, to come and just engage with it freshly as part of its concept?
It's quite stunning the degree to which, while I'm aware of the university ethics issues, I don't engage with them in my practice. I think what ethics is about, protecting the rights and the agencies and the livedness, whatever. It's protecting people from research being conducted in such a way that is considered to be unethical. And so I think the role of ethics is to prove that you are not going to exploit in a negative way. You're not going to impinge upon the rights of people. I'm not being pushed to go through that process, but at the same time, there has been expectation that when you work with human participants, that you are aware of what constitutes ethical approval or the need for ethical approval. I've never sought ethical approval for the projects that I've done, because I don't think that the terms of engagement that my work operates on is about that notion of them revealing something of themselves, or an anthropological, sociological engagement with them one way. I'm having an artistic negotiation in a particular space.
It's this kind of area that it seems that a lot of people are like, oh, ethics. Oh, I've got to get ethics approval. And there's this kind of fear around it. And I think maybe because that process of going for ethics approval in these institutions is built around language that is really unfamiliar and seems really discordant to performance practices. So I think there's kind of a lot of taboo or fear or kind of distance around that whole procedure. It'd be really good for it not to be like that. It would be good that it was actually really was about taking care. You know, that's why we would be going through that process, would be about the best care for the situation that you could create.
To some extent, we always recognise ethical concerns as part of being performance makers. I think ethics and, you know, as a maker, you're going to think about ethics in some way.
Or to go back to.
But I mean, it depends on how you think about ethics. I mean, in terms of like the university's definition of the human ethics committee, They're extremely limiting. So it sort of depends on how you define ethics.
We can never know. We can never safeguard against the unexpected. And you wouldn't want to in live performance. That is the beauty of it. That in itself blows apart the whole kind of form filling of human ethics and participants. When you talk about participants in your research, and from a university point of view, this is where the conversation is really needs to happen. How do you get an ethics approval for that? In terms of university approved ethics of human participation, because the audience are participating in your research as performance, as the event, they're taking the risk too.
For me, it's interesting. Ethics is much more about when you start to work with groups of people to make projects about those communities. And I don't make that kind of work. And so for me, that's partly why I skirt around the ethics. And I have to say, I do. I skirt around it.
I endeavour to be ethical in all elements of my practice, but I'm confident that, you know, there's lots of things that I haven't thought through. And lots, you know, and so many issues that you could address or consider or look at from different standpoints, which is the more kind of academic approach.
An audience is not a participant, in the same way that somebody reading a book is not a participant. So we don't ask people to take their books to the ethics committee. But somehow, because I think artists function in this space around social interaction and quite often provocation, it's almost like they like to have the idea that they have to take it to the ethics committee, you know. And I've seen ethics committee being absolutely confounded by what was put in front of them, and either saying, well, this isn't an ethical matter because actually you're not talking about participants, you're talking about audience, in that separation in the way that a book would have an audience. Or getting into questions of taste, you know, like that's really offensive to me. So where does taste end and how do we talk about offence? Some people are offended by green and orange put together, you know. As a child, I was terrified of red. You know, so does this mean people have to take responsibility for my terror of red every time they make a painting? Well, not really, not really.
Mm. But then what then is a participant? Or when does someone become a participant?
Well, I think it's when they are agreed to be the object of study, as it were, and that you're going to take findings from them, and that they have an ownership of something to do with the project. So so it's a point where a collaboration starts to begin, and there are really fuzzy areas, I think, and I think they come up, and I think it doesn't surprise me you've chosen performance as a place where this would come up.
Yeah, we're all free to do whatever we like with participants, and not have to get ethical approval for it. It's when, we're doing formal research within a university context, and where it is in the public domain, and it is in the public domain as research undertaken by somebody who is doing it in the name of this institution, that's where ethical approval is required. So
I conducted an interview in Perth around a hedphonic work there, and I wanted to gather information and actually do a questionnaire, so it was a lot more formal, and so I went through the ethics process for that, and so I also became accustomed with the kind of questions that I was required to ask of my participants. And it was okay for a questionnaire, but in terms of them participating in an event that is about the encounter itself, then the process of ethics, it's how do you kind of get around that without undoing the conditions of your work or negating the conditions of your work.
Certainly that idea of informed consent. Yeah.
So that could be problematic in that scenario. Yeah. And actually even in my first, one of my earlier presentations, it was the end of my first year of my PhD research, and I actually went through a very formal process where they signed an agreement about how the images were going to be used. And it sets up a certain expectation of the work from the outset, and I found that really difficult. And compromising to the kind of environment I wanted them to experience. And so I've been looking for ways of building that into the conditions of the work so that it just becomes part of the setup in a more gentle way, so that they're agreeing, they're giving consent, they know what the conditions are in terms of any kind of recordings that will be reused, but they're not having to take form like the one we did for the interview, where they read a set of conditions, and which is what actually the ethics, formal ethics process asks you to do.
It requires a degree of foresight and articulation of methodology and outcome that does not fit easily with the emergent and intuitive nature of performance making.
It doesn't grapple seriously with the idea of collaboration. And in performance, in devising performances, quite often contemporary choreographers and performers work collaboratively. That's an issue that has to be considered as well. With who owns or who is in control, whose findings they are, you know, whose knowledge.
I guess here we've got a separation between university life and the art world as such, and we negotiate that separation all the time. Like, I'm often asked about PhD degrees. You know, we offer PhD degrees which are loosely termed creative practice PhDs. The only thing that creative practice signifies is that there's a large exhibition component in relationship to an exegesis, and the exegesis can be up to about 50,000 words and often longer, you know, 80,000 words. So often candidates are doing an exhibition plus a full written PhD, you know, so they can be really, really big projects. Now, I'm often asked, you know, why do artists need to do a PhD? Well, they don't. I mean, there's plenty of really good artists around who are interesting practicing artists who don't do PhDs. PhDs are attached to the university context, and they're a university structure. And the idea is, and I believe in it, is that this depth of research that we can offer artists, which is more reading, more thinking, more articulating, more critiquing, more talking about, both with practice and with writing and ideas, can make people more interesting artists. And I think that in most cases it does. I think by and large that art school experiences do feed into the art world, but with that comes a university structure with its code of ethics. And there we see a collision between some forms of behaviour.
And in the early days, I think, you know, you'd set up a school of art and design ethics committee, and there's this huge confusion between morality and ethics, and I think that still exists for artists when considering this matter. And then there's also you notice the huge confusion between ethics, morality, and taste, you know, and also a lack of understanding that your audience is not your participant. And I think this is the point where I started to get really interested and started to feel more relaxed about it. Because we've been in situations where people were told that perhaps they shouldn't do performance work or an artwork because it was offensive. And, you know, that we had a lot of discussion about that, and we brought people in to art historians to look at the role of art and the notion of conscience and critic of society and all of those sorts of things. And, you know, I came firmly to the belief that being offensive is not an ethical issue, actually, in terms of an ethics committee, in terms of human participation.
When the notion of ethics is used, and when you look at ethics application processes, the primary concern is not what I would define as fundamentally the concern of ethics, but the concern of risk management. And risk management concerns primarily the responsibility of an agent to participants in their agency, and the responsibility of the agent themselves to themselves, and the responsibility of the agent to, in this case, as in a university, to the institution in which they are performing. And so when you look at ethics committees and the application process and the evaluation of projects, what is primarily the concern is looking at risk with respect to participants' engagements, with respect to the applicant and with respect to the university, and mitigating risks. Not eliminating risks necessarily, but mitigating them. In the sense that there are some risks that are what you might call low level, and there are some risks that are life-threatening. Life-threatening risks you don't mitigate so much as you try and eliminate. But there are other range of risks, say that you might put yourself in harm's way as a researcher, and there are certain mitigating protocols, or you might inconvenience participants in your research, or you might be insensitive to participants. And you can't absolutely avoid that necessarily, but you can mitigate the risks of doing so. So there's a whole risk management process or dimension to the question of ethics.
The concern for Māori researchers who looked at these procedures, you know, were thinking, well, actually the focus needs to be on the protecting the communities whose knowledge you're dealing with, whose bodies you're dealing with, you know.
And also not necessarily protecting so much as, because if you're protecting, that's a kind of paternalistic relationship, so much as enabling the community whose knowledge it is to make determinations.
Yeah. Well, that's the most fun stage in the process, isn't it? Yes, you protect them from the possibility that they might be taken advantage of, but then facilitating and enabling them to take control. Or have a say or benefit.
It's the university's protection of itself, I think, is a very big part of it.
And that it's actually not really, really looking at the scenario, you know, it's looking at the scenario from a liability perspective as opposed to a really what's going on perspective, you know. Yeah, I don't know. There's a kind of a gap in the language. And I suppose it's a fiscal, financial thing. The liability comes about probably a lot around money rather than actual...
Or image.
Yeah, reputations.
I think there's possibly a risk that we're operating in a dual kind of worlds with this, because I think there's I can see it becoming more and more of an issue. I think there's the... Those of us who do work in academia, there is a kind of, you know, some of the discussion at the moment in this university at least is about getting research university funding for projects but not having ethics approval for them, for things that happen outside of the university. For instance, in a professional arts context where there is an expectation of risks of a certain kind being taken. And a sort of a sense of what is free, you know, what is freedom in a sense in relation to that. I think that's an interesting word. So there's a sort of risk that we're operating in a kind of doubleness going on there, I think. Those of us who work as creative artists who work in academia.
Yeah. It was a large interdisciplinary collaborative research project. And it wasn't the first time that these sorts of issues had come up where... you had a real mix of researchers working together, some coming from the sciences, some coming from the arts, some coming from the creative arts. So all together to create a performance project that also had interviews and other means of gathering information. It was very interesting to see the diverse perspectives coming together and, in a way, have these moments of clash. Not always clash, but just very interesting discussions around how do we approach this, that from, to label the groups, from the more creative side of things, there was this expectation we don't need this ethics process in this that is run through this institution, because we were obviously funded by this institution. There were some of us saying, well, we have to adhere to these processes. They're supporting this, you know. We can't kind of just randomly go out there and hope for the best, you know. So there was some perspective saying we have to go through this ethics process for not only collecting interviews but for the performance, for the public engagement. And then there were others saying, oh, but we're artists, you know. We just go and make our art. If we have to stop someone and give them a consent form, it's going to break the atmosphere. It's not going to... They're going to run away. They're not going to want to give their perspectives. They'll think, what is this? So this kind of clash happened, and essentially it kind of never was resolved. It was that those that wanted to engage with the public and get them to do the ethics that was required of this institution did that, and those that didn't want to didn't. And I just found it very interesting that there was this, it kind of created also various hierarchies and agendas coming up through that, because people were using the oh, I'm a this such and such person, I need to do this, this and this. I'm a such and such person, and what I do, I don't need this.
I think ethics straddles a range of different aspects of research, part of which pertains to what I do as a performance practitioner, which is around human participation, and a lot of which is to do with ethics, to do with animals, and that kind of broader university sort of pan engagement with ethical issues for treatment of, you know, animals, etc. And I work at a university that has a lot of that aspect to it, so we have quite a heavy duty ethics component.
In thinking it through and remembering that in universities most ethics committees came about because of issues around research on animals, so all of what you're being asked about is really to ensure that you're not going to be cruel to animals. And then later on people thought, well, we probably shouldn't be cruel to human beings either, which is an interesting way around. But so understanding that when I was putting something up in front of an ethics committee, what they were really ascertaining was, if I was working on animals or on people, what might be the negative impact of that, and what should I be responsible for?
I mean, I had this experience with Santiago Sierra. Santiago Sierra wanted to let a truck full of sheep off into the downstairs foyer of St. Paul Street. And there was a situation where I was asked as chair of St. Paul Street to give permission for this to happen. And I turned down the basis of, you know, possible damage to the floor. I mean, I think that the hooves of the sheep would have damaged the floor. That was my least, like, I'll go in there, this is my least concern. The second concern, running up the scale of being deeply concerned, was that the sheep were being sheep, because I know about sheep, my brother's a farmer, and all that, you know, would get into the lifts, and they'd be all over the place, and it would block the whole building from functioning for most of a day. And the third concern was animal rights. I mean, my biggest concern was animal rights. I mean, we would have had SPCA and other animal rights, you know, it would have been a potential disaster. And I said, no, I can't do this. I have to talk to my head of school, who was Desna Durin. I rang Desna and she said no, and I agreed. But it was just this interesting moment between Santiago Sierra and myself, when it was just this face-off. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And he said, the artist is always right. You're making a mistake. So to be looked at, and he's, you know, it was close. And he had his Ray Burns on. It was just like, the artist is always right. You're making a mistake. And he turned and walked off, and I never talked to him again. Now, this to me is just, you know, I in a way I respect his right to say that, but I also think that I made the right decision and I'd make that decision again.
Because if the artist is always right, where does that stop?
Yeah, exactly. And so if we're talking about performance and participation as a contingency of enactment, coming back to the Amelia Jones point, we can't operate ethically like that. We have to consider participants and performance in the context of performance. actions at every step. Now, I can see he was probably doing that and realising that his action would cause harm, both in terms of the fabric of the building and in terms of day-to-day life of the people using the building, and in terms of the animals as well. And he was obviously just not interested in that, or maybe he was interested in it, but just was willing for the harm to take place. So, and I think had we had more of a lead-up to that event and gone to the Ethics Committee, it would have been turned down, because it would have been seen as harmful to animals, apart from anything else, you know. So that's another good example of this kind of face-off, as you called it, which is a great way of putting it, between, you know, artistic, a sort of vacuum of artistic so-called talent and genius and individuality versus social context, and in this case the university.
I think we're past the days of presuming that art inhabits some kind of vacuum separate from social values and interactions of people. Yeah, it's it has an agency in that sense, doesn't it? Yeah, it's part of the interaction of people. Aesthetics as being somehow detached from that, or values of art being detached from that, I find it very passé.
But I do believe that for art to be effective, it needs to be free of social regulation. And if, you know, I'm aware of kind of, particularly working in universities, for example, they have a very strict ethical guide around things. And I think, from my point of view, that really restricts playful research. And what it does effectively is remove the responsibility of the individual, because what it says is, here, written down on this article, is the rules. So
yeah,
that's the rules you'll follow. So it sort of allows the individual to disengage, and I think that's not helpful in the artistic process.
A colleague the other day, she came across an article where a woman who was a cultural anthropologist was doing observation of a community, and in fact of the way in which children in a particular community acted. And her observational technique was one of not being engaged at all with that community, but watching it from a distance. And she discovered that the children were systematically kind of tattooing themselves or one another in this community. Then she was discovering that the children were contracting AIDS. And she didn't intervene, but it was only she didn't intervene immediately, but it was after a while that she began to see the causal relation between the children's tattooing and them getting AIDS and not using sterilized needles. And so because she didn't act immediately, there were children who contracted AIDS. And she was faced with a double dilemma with respect to her ethics. Her professional ethics as an anthropologist said, do not intervene in this community, otherwise it will radically affect the findings that I'm trying to discern. And then she had a personal ethics or another kind of ethical responsibility with respect to the well-being of people. And eventually she, after soul-searching and reflection, she abandoned the ethical procedures that she had taken up with respect to her research protocols, and has adopted a whole other set of research ethics.
That seems to be the way that a lot of ethical procedures have been developed, mm-hmm. not just in the arts, but in sociology, for example, or in medicine, where research has occurred, it's become clear after the fact.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely the case. You know, when I've talked to people who are not artists, who are on the ethics committees, and explain to me where this came about from, that's clearly what's happened. You know, people were doing terrible things to monkeys. So, you know, and people thought, should we be doing this? And that's how these processes came about. Nobody thought, if I do this to the monkey, will they
what should I do? Is that an ethical problem? It doesn't seem, you're absolutely right, it doesn't seem to work that way.
If we take another situation where somebody is engaging in, where somebody is engaging in research and they might not have participants in that research, say even a performance artist who is working in a performance occasion or event that doesn't necessarily have a prescribed or defined audience, and that doesn't have other performers, and it doesn't. So, it, in one respect, a performance agency that doesn't have participants, and I can think of an example of one that I've encountered where that happens. The performer still has an ethical responsibility outside of the issue of risk management, an ethical responsibility with respect to what you might call a certain, could be vague or it could be specific, notion of normativity, of what acceptable behaviour is and what is not in some way going to harm the greater good. So an example I can give that is slightly outside of the performance arena is where at a university in New Zealand, somebody did a PhD, research on the history of the Holocaust. And after enormous research and evaluation, their findings were that the Holocaust did not happen. And they didn't need to get ethical approval for this research because according to, under the guidelines of the university, there wasn't the requirement to have ethical approval. But there is another dimension to ethics, which is the comportment of candidates and their supervisors to the nature of the research they're doing and the effects of that research in a broader community. When this candidate's research hit the press, as somebody alerted the press to it, the university was, say, greatly embarrassed by it. There was a lot of explaining to do as to why this candidate... It became a heated issue. That is, it's not that the candidate might not have legitimately come up with that after exhaustive research as a conclusion to their research, but the way in which it was managed and the way in which it was negotiated with all of the communities that could be harmed by the outcome of that research, they weren't negotiated. And so there was an ethical dimension to that research over and above what a university's ethics committees usually have as their remit.
And I guess with medicine and nursing and science, thinking about cruelty to animals or experiments on human subjects, I suspect, and I'm out of my field here, but I suspect that the issues about ethics are clearer because all those experiments have to apply to clear normative and applied ethical standards. Whereas in performance art, we have this sort of vacuum where some of those standards are tested and where we enter into that first category of ethics, which is more of a philosophical play and inquiry about ethics and inquiry about standards and inquiry that can function on a poetic level, which can test out and violate kind of normative understandings. It's like Roland Barthes' writing on the text versus the work. You know, the text is a poetic, artistic kind of unfolding which can break metaphor and representation, clear understandings of how the world operates, and it can violate meaning. So the text can be, in its poetic understanding, can upset representation. And representation and mimesis, you know, go hand in hand with kind of a clear ethical understanding of ethics and clear social structure. So there's no easy answer here, and we have to constantly negotiate our way through performance art and ethics.
Indeed.
And take it on a case-by-case basis. But clearly, there are some things that can't happen in the university environment.
See, I think you just... I mean, I always think, would these great pieces of work have happened if there had been some sort of ethical over, you know, an idea. Well, I think moral often rather than ethical overlay on top of this, and moral taste involved in this. This offends my taste is quite often what the issue is, and I think it's not. I'm prepared to say, mind your own business, ethics committee. You know,
this is the really tricky thing because half of what a lot of art is trying to do is push those boundaries. In a performance, we are trying to push boundaries, whether that is physically push boundaries or through what we're trying to speak about through this performance or that performance is test how far can we go. So I'm not sure whether people would be so willing to test those boundaries if they had to adhere to this strict, this outline of what they should be considering and having to, you know, sign on the dotted line type thing. It perhaps would make people quite nervous about going near those things, and it might go into that situation that we were talking about before where people just avoid and go, oh, I'm going to play it safe because I don't want to run any risks. And I mean, it's even within, you see it happening kind of health and safety wise within performances, people will go, oh, what they would have done once upon a time, oh yes, we'll do this and we'll abseil down here, and now people will go, oh, that will just get too crazy, we won't even go there. Already you see it kind of happening there sometimes where people will avoid it if it's not absolutely kind of necessary to the artistic vision. It's like, oh well, we can find another way of maybe doing that and not have to go through that process. And I see kind of extreme versions of that in performances within a Middle Eastern context where censorship is huge, and how people negotiate that role and how also inherently censorship, they self-censor. So that's probably the extreme version of, and I mean that's censorship rather than ethics, but still there's a kind of a consideration, a constant consideration of that that goes on in almost all of the creative work that I was seeing in different ways. So it becomes embedded within an environment, but we don't need that censorship here or that. So there's this freedom, and this freedom kind of can go in all different ways, and sometimes that goes outside of perhaps the ethical parameters, whether that's an institutional version of ethics or a broader sense of how it is to behave ethically.
A lot of performance arts made its name through boundary pushing. But I don't think there's a lot of boundary pushing to be done with it in this terrain anymore, so to speak. Because what performance art has done, as has done a lot of other visual arts practices, is that it's given permission for artists to do almost anything.
How do we evaluate Yoko Ono's cut, where she puts herself in a place where people abuse her? Or Marina Abramovic, where they put themselves in a place where they have made that decision that they could be abused, and people choose to participate by abusing or not abusing. That's where the fine line is in terms of what a university ethics committee might think. And a university ethics committee would not, if you put that in front, if you put either of those projects in front of an ethics committee, there's no way they would sanction that. There's no way, but they're two of the greatest pieces, you know, in performance art. They're seminal pieces, or Stuart Brisley lying in, you know, in innards, in a stinking innards, to enact the poetry of that. Well, I mean, gosh, he could have caught something terrible from those innards. Would a university ethics committee allow that? And I suspect no. So where do we then stand on that, and how do we argue that to an ethics committee? And we say, I think we have to say that this is not what the intention of their project is. And where people have taken a position which could be described as within that conscience and critic of society role, that the fact of being offensive is actually part of that, and it's the audience or participants' engagement, because they're still audience, but they have an invitation in the way that they can be involved in it, are still working within their own responsibility. So where is the responsibility is the key for the harm, or where is the harm? And I think, in my view, as long as you can define the relationship, not define the relationship. As long as you're aware that you're in a discussion which will raise moral and ethical issues, and that the artwork itself is a discussion of those moral and ethical issues, and that the performers perform and the participants, if you like to want to call them participants, the audience who choose to interact, are making their own choices within that, then I'm not sure it is within the purview
of the ethics committee
in the way that it's set up and what it's supposed to consider.
At the moment, the way it stands, it feels like it totally is restricting. Like if you were to, for example, if you were to ask Chris Burdens, like from just from my head, if he had to apply for ethics approval through the university, then he wouldn't get it for that proposal. So yes, that would become impossible. So therefore, that would be restricting of artistic processes. So that's a real difficulty, and I don't know what the answer is for that.
At the same time, and this kind of comes, but I think then of the guy who shut himself in his studio for an entire year, in a cage, and you know, at what point do we, as also a participatory community, have responsibility to go, well, actually, no, we are opening this door and we're taking you out because you're going mad.
Yeah.
You know, kind of idea that ethics kind of goes both ways, that we actually have responsibility it's not just the performer or the individual who's initiating a
Absolutely.
Project that has responsibility, but it's those who choose to attend that have responsibility, or those who choose to produce or host performance who have a responsibility to consider ethics.
Yes, and in that respect, sometimes those works are perhaps asking exactly that question of those people who are attending, and so...
Yeah, and what does it mean if we don't break down the
exactly.
door and let him
and
say,
that,
stop
and
it?
So that becomes part of the work. So the boundaries of where the work lies in relation to how you negotiate that kind of ethical approach is part of it. So how do you write an ethics form that allows for that? If I wanted to start creating work that was high risk, I don't know how you'd approach that in an academic context without totally just ignoring the
context and then being disciplined and losing your job.
Exactly.
There's been such a rise in performance professionals working in universities.
And so that is a really new scenario. Previously, it's been kind of renegade people just doing their own thing, and there's a certain kind of seductiveness in that, that's kind of allows them. But, you know, is that ethically responsible?
There's a lot of exploration that's possible to do that might be kind of somewhat oriented by those well-known kind of in the canon, those really well-known works, but that there's a whole lot of very interesting stuff that is possible to engage with that doesn't necessarily involve that kind of situation, and that still involves ethics, or it still involves a relation of ethics and politics, or there's not a sort of imperative to, if you really want to be a performance artist, you have to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think there's lots of room for exploration that is still there.
There's definitely things we do not sanction at, say, St Paul's Street Gallery at AUT University, to be specific. And there's clearly things that we might take more of a risk on. that I imagine being chair of any art space or Art Space Sydney, it has part of its role, being chair and the director, would be a governance role about risk management and about ethics. And the council, the arts councils, will have ethical guidelines drawn up because they're government departments. Mm. So there'll be a trickle-down effect to these spaces depending on their funding. And with public funding comes public responsibility. And so, but I imagine, but having said that, a space like Sydney Art Space is going to be freer than a space like St Paul Street, a university gallery, to carry out some more risky activities. But then, you know, universities are interesting because we probably have more leeway, I suspect, than say Te Papa. I suspect because Te Papa is a direct line government department, you know, with a lot of staff and committees and so forth. So I suspect that, you know, the university context is going to be in the middle of some of the others. But the instance of an ethics committee clips our wings to a large degree on that, which we might take risk on. But also at the same time, our disciplines and our ways of acting in art and performance art stretch the ethics committee, and that's a really important point. Like, they're really stretched by us, and they're challenged by us, and they really enjoy a lot of the problems we throw at them. I mean, you know, I hear quite often from the committee that our applications are some of the most interesting because they're not clear cut, and they involve a lot of discussion about the nature of ethics and the way in which it's a movable feast.
My sense really is that the ethical issue at university is really at a research level. So for undergrad students, it's just literally kind of, we need to understand a few codes of conduct here about ourselves, safety to ourselves, the position of the university. And, you know, we get stuff, students trying to self-harm in the name of art, jumping off roofs, you know, vandalising property as artistic strategies. We get that. I'm sure AUT gets it. Everyone gets it. But I think the issue around ethics is more at a research level. So I have had a couple of instances where students have got ethics clearance, particularly photographers, curiously, for their representation of communities or what have you. And I think we do need to identify very early on in the piece when they're proposing their research, whether it has the potential for the need for a low-level ethics approval or whether it needs a full-blown ethics approval. And I think it's just about understanding the nature of the research and then working with them to identify whether it needs an ethics approval or not. So I think it is really crucial, especially when they're dealing with human participants.
Well, this is a tricky one for us when we're advising students on going to AUTEC. AUTEC is the AUT Ethics Committee. Because they can do some of that social contextual involvement before they think about applying for ethics. So you see, they can be researching and gathering information about communities and talking to people and maybe even doing some video footage and stuff. Think of the kind of work that looks at more relational aesthetics work, that looks at social communities and videoing, say, Pacific communities, whatever kind of communities. Think of Janet Lelo's work, where there's school leavers and other members of the Pacific community just, you know, being videoed, sitting on the loo, talking about their lives, you know, interacting with each other in the street, smoking, you know, drinking, talking. So we sometimes get students who are involved with those kinds of research activities and with maybe even forming artworks around this, around those ideas. And this is a natural part of the research process. And then they go, oh, or we go, oh, this is using human subjects. Your work's developed in this direction. Maybe you didn't tell us or we weren't alert enough to it at the time. You need to apply for ethics. Now, the stringent ethical point of view, the committee's point of view, is that none of that material can be used until after the point at which ethics has been granted. And, of course, there's a grey line here that we constantly have to work and negotiate, that you know, we sometimes can try and backdate an ethical approval or you know, say that the work has come after that point. But that can be a tricky thing to do. We try not to do that, obviously. But clearly, there's a point at which applying for ethics can slow up a creative process and put a spanner in the works, you know, because suddenly there's this institutional requirement that has to be done. But because we're a university and because ethics is largely to do with risk management on the part of the university, we do need to go through those processes. And I don't, with society as it stands and the number of students we have, the number of universities in the world, the way in which these activities are blossoming, you know, just this, just the numerical increase of everything happening and the nature of the law, I think I don't see any easy way out of this, out of that risk management situation. I mean, we're in a different context from the 1960s. Even when I was at art school in the late 1980s, you know, I mean, we didn't have an ethics committee, I don't think.
Actually, I spent quite a lot of a whole course, you know, a quarter of a full-time, you know, course load of study, or 15-point course is what we call it, in both our universities. And we're looking at kind of issues to do, and this is in a dance context, because this is where I'm employed, mostly. We look at kind of ethics, notions of ethics, and their views of ethics, and different other people's views of ethics, and so-called experts' views of ethics in relation to issues that are in performance and dance in this country. And very often it's to do, you know, there's stuff to do with cultural ownership and the Treaty of Waitangi. So yeah. That's a big way I engage with, is engaging with the Treaty of Waitangi and its implications for students. And what that does is the treaty, for me, provides some fluid but somewhat concrete signpost of ethics or ethical value systems in the law, so to speak. And basically, it gets students exercising their own minds and value systems about what's right and what's wrong, what should you do, what shouldn't you do. And very often it's about, you know, allowing people who are different to you to get their, you know, role. So I get students to discuss a lot, and sometimes they write essays. It's a theory course, and we're looking at different things and issues, and they argue stuff out. So that's one way. And I don't tell them what to think about that stuff. I say, this is where it's going. I'm deliberately not going to make you think this stuff. But these are the issues that you have to consider. You know, notions of privileging, inclusion, exclusion, and then within that, sometimes there's notions of boundaries and safety. What are these things to you? Where are you going with this? Let's do some exercises about this stuff. You know, acceptability, unacceptability, these kind of things. Often through physical exercises that are provoking, and students come up with stuff, you know, quite interestingly. And very often it's with performance art-based work. Students are trying stuff out and they're confronting it while I'm with them, or, you know, issues that they haven't thought about, and then they're learning about it through those kind of things. For instance, what happens if you've got a crowd of people and you've got someone just throwing themselves around through them? How do you deal with that? You know, and that person's blindfolded too, so, you know. Yeah, what do you say if you're going to interrogate someone with their clothes off in public? Or, well, they're all these kind of things. And often we revert back to, like I said earlier, but kind of, you know, notions of our law in terms of the justice system and things like that. What is possible, what isn't possible, questions you've asked me, what are you responsible for, what should you be responsible for, what should the audience be responsible for?
In terms of the human ethics structure of the university, it's sort of set up for interviewing, not for performance making, you know, where we're working with dancers who, in the university setting, if it was performance research that you were doing, you'd generally be using quite experienced, although not always, it would depend on the kind of research it was, but
There's a kind of, you know, there's a kind of questions.
Well, there's a kind of risk that's part of dance studies in terms of, okay, we're going to do a turn. You're going to take this person's weight. And you can be doing it safely, but the ethics committee just isn't really geared up for thinking through physical labour in terms of creative practice. They're set up to think about interview questions, interview methodologies, social science methodologies, and hard science methodologies. But practice-led research has a really different sort of realm of assumptions in terms of the methods that will be used to generate material. The ethics process also is really very time-consuming and can take months. So that time, if you were doing, you know, masters or PhD work in performance, is really, it's a lot of waiting and a lot of paperwork. It's totally logocentric. So I think that university's ethics would require
vast rethinking,
quite a bit of rethinking, in order to be kind of genuinely responsive to ethical issues in performance that could come up. That isn't to say that artists and artist academics don't do ethics, because I know lots of situations where people have gone through the ethics process, and I have. And it's often when you want to get the process articulated. So when you're making a work and then you want to interview your dancers about, you know, have the dancer's voice about the process, what's going on, how is the knowledge being developed, that kind of thing.
I know they changed the ethics process for art and design in at AUT. Like, when I was doing my MPhil, I had to do an ethics application.
Yeah.
So, and that went through, I think, it was more a kind of standardised university-wide, closer to the standard university-wide process. So that caused, well, it was quite a process to get it through. Not as much of a process as people maybe 1 or 2 years prior to me, but I think the key issue for my thing was like that the participants were professional performers, so professionally trained people. So that was the kind of key point that we made, that my supervisors and I made, that sort of enabled the work to go ahead, because it was like the criterion was, would this project cause risk beyond what might be experienced in daily life? And if the daily life of the person is to be a professional performer who would have some training and expertise and ability to know what risks are involved and so on, that was a key point, and that helped get it through. But now I know that the ethics thing has been changed since then.
There are a whole other range of ethical protocols. So, for example, somebody making a film, there is a professional body with respect to making films that requires you to sign off on professional ethics. So this is another domain. Professional ethics that sits outside of university context. Mm. And so if anybody taking photographs, there is a consent form, a professional ethical consent form.
And so when we move from a private space into some kind of publishing public context, all these issues still apply. And I guess ethics within the university context is really good training ground for that. So we also don't, I like your point, we don't need to be apologetic about it. We need to say, well, this is going to play out in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
A couple of years, about 5 years ago, the university accepted the notion that where in performance works, which might be a live performance works by performance artists, or in film or in photography, where you have participants who are required either to be photographed, to be filmed, or to be engaged with in performance, and those participants are themselves professional, then ethical approval is not required, because professional ethics will cover those participants. And the definition of being professional is not that they are registered somewhere, but that in you advertising for models, for actors, for participants in a performance work, if they reply, then they are considered to be professionals in those fields. So it is greatly alleviated this terrible conundrum around the fact that we had photographers who were hiring professional models and then having to justify the ethical frameworks for what they were doing when these models were, it was their everyday occupation. So now ethical approval is not required where you're using participants who themselves are professional in that, in precisely what they'll be doing as participants.
The one that I struggle with is the degree to which it's important that I engage with an ethics approval process for my projects, or the degree to which what I do sits outside of that. That is the question. I think we have a capacity to sweep it under the carpet and think, no, it's too hard. It's
Or there's that kind of special pleading for art. I mean, yeah. The sense of it is art.
Yeah, we're different.
We're different.
Yeah. That's also
And I think that's a really important question. I mean, you know, if there is a move to actually go, okay, yes, we'll engage the human ethics process at the university, we want it to change.
Yeah.
How much of that demand to change is especially, is it, we're art, we're different, we should be allowed to do things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how much of that we should be allowed to do things is actually a justified and defendable position, and how much of that is just a historic kind of entitlement.
Freedom of expression. I mean, one of the other questions is how much we trust artists to make decisions that are appropriate for the public good.
One of my candidates actually wanted to have, as a performance work, a board of directors having a meeting. And on discussing his proposal for a performance work, because this was at the very beginning of his candidature, we'd applied for ethical approval to get it. And this was really early on with our AUT Ethics Committee. And they were stymied by it. Absolutely stymied by it, and it took like 12 months, and then he kind of moved on. And then we thought maniacally, we want to have a project where the ethics committee, where the performance is the ethics committee deliberating on that proposal. That's the performance work. And if the ethics committee agreed to that performance work, who would they get ethical approval from? which is a beautiful way of asking, you know, who are they in, what constitutes the ethical framework, I mean, what constitutes the ethical approval of the ethics committee?
But I think the thing that you've really pushed into my thinking today, Melissa, is just that sense of what is my responsibilities ethically as a university researcher in pushing audiences into levels of self-reflexivity that may not ordinarily choose to do. Because I hold that as sacrosanct. I wouldn't make work if I couldn't do that. And if the ethics process hindered the potential for me to make that work, I simply wouldn't make the work if I worked in a university context, which I do. Or I'd have to leave the university context just to make that work. So for me, it's probably about saying, I'm very aware of notions of agency and politics. I consider myself a politicized artist. I consider myself someone who's very, very interested in notions of difference and diversity. And I'm not at all interested in exploiting people. So as a set of value systems in terms of how I interact, I use that as a buttress against thinking that I need to somehow have ethical approval for what it is that I do. Because if I went down that line, and I think it kills the immediacy and the beauty of the unguarded moment. I mean, I have to defend the unguarded moment, because if I lose the unguarded moment, it's not happening.
Yeah.
So if that means that what I do is ethically problematic, then that's when it gets into a space where we're in trouble. I'm in trouble with the university's understanding. And if the university can't accommodate art in that way, if I think it's ethically committed, and I would argue that it is ethically committed, then we're in trouble. I think then performance is definitely in trouble within academia, because then we're going to end up instrumentalizing it to the point at which it won't function with any value. So I think we have to defend that territory.
Mm.
But it's easy for me to justify that because I think I'm an ethical person. If I wasn't an ethical person, then I think, you know, I could be exploiting people. You could argue that there are things that I've done that are exploitational. It's a very grey area.